Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, do you remember how you learned about broadcast engineering and radio production? How to get around a radio station? What was all there? Well, James Copeland is here. He's a young engineer, and he's reminding us how fun it was to learn what you're doing in broadcast engineering, learning electronics, and just how the systems work. That's coming up on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby Console from Lavo. See Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twert. And by Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and lots of digital stuff in between. Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad you're here. I'm coming to you from my place of business, the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Glad to have Telos Alliance sponsoring my studio, and that's just terrific. Really appreciate them very much. And by the way, they're also my employer. So if I say something nice about them, well, it's well deserved, and they pay me a bit. So there you go. And if you have a question about Telos or Axia or Omnia Gear or something like that, I probably have some good insight into that too. So if I speak well of them, hey, that's why. I like them. All right. Our show, episode 424, we've got a great guest coming up in just a minute. But right now, let's head on over to the New York City area, Newark, New Jersey, where Chris Tobin is standing by. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Well, hello, Kirk. Hello, James. Yes, I'm here at the Holiday Studio Annex having a good time. So it's nice. Nice and festive.
The Holiday Studio. Tell me about that piano. That looks like a Steinway.
It is a Steinway B, and it was purchased back in 1980, and it's a doozy. It's everything about it is old. How is it put to me? It's old wood. That's what it is. When you play this piano, you really have to work the keys. It's not like some of the new stuff that you have, newer pianos. And that's from piano players we've had come through here, Grammy Award-winning artists, so I'm going to take their word for it.
Does any of the piano players complain that it's that you got to play it?
No, actually, they welcome it. There are some folks that are like, oh man, I haven't played something like this since I was a kid. You know, it's like I'm sitting listening, like, okay, well, we just had a tune this morning, and Jason does a very nice job, and is it okay? And they're like, this is great. This, and I have to say, for those in the audience who are not musicians, you have to understand that musicians, I guess sort of like broadcast engineers when it comes to finessing transmitters and understanding how to make them work back in the day of vacuum tubes when you really had to tweak those knobs. Mm-hmm. Some of the musicians that come through are true artisans of their craft. I had one person with the piano. She was playing this and hitting keys, listening, and going, do you hear that? I can't get that on my piano at home. I'm like, well, what piano do you have? And it's another competitor, another brand. And she goes, no, that's a Steinway sound. I'm sitting there going, I need to learn these things. So I'm starting to learn this stuff. I'm going, you know, you're right. Because we also do some broadcasts and recordings at another facility in New York City that has a different type of piano, different manufacturer. So I got a chance to compare both. And I'm going, you know, she's absolutely right. I never understood that. And then we had a saxophone player in 6 months ago who had a saxophone that he bought at a pawn shop like 30 years ago for $20, something really ridiculous. He was, you know, had no money. He's just making it, doing his thing. Had no idea that what he bought was this world-known, renowned saxophone that was designed in such a way back in the 30s. And people would see and go, I had no idea they still made those. He's like, what are you talking about? And when he found out how much it's worth and what he paid for it, he plays that like, you know, it's sweet as it can be. I mean, we recorded him in his trio. We did a shoot video, and the way he plays it, you can appreciate the sound. And that's something I think is missing a lot today in some of the music that people listen to. These things, this piano, we have a Rhodes keyboard downstairs that we bring up when we need it. We have a Hammond C3 organ that we'll roll out when Christian Sands comes by and decides he wants to play. And it's like, I'm going to do both organ and piano. And when you listen to these folks, and I'm not talking about people who are playing musicians who are in their 80s. I'm talking about musicians in their mid-30s and 40s and 20s and people who are really know how to just play the music. It just, it's unbelievable. There's nothing, you can't beat it. So this piano is a Steinway behind me, and it is definitely one of the early, you know, 1980s, you know, machine. And I don't know what else to tell you. It's just unbelievable. When you hear it, I can now say when I'm listening to a recording, oh, I know exactly which piano that is. I can tell you. And there's sax and trumpets, and there's some basses I can even tell you about too. You know, I just, you now understand this, the, you know, the finer art. It's just like, and I will relate to what we're doing. If you're a broadcast engineer and you're listening to a radio station, you're marketing, you go, ah, that is an 8100. I know that sound.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, no. Good. That's an Omni 11. Yep. I know that one. Or back in the day, because nowadays with the new solid state transmitter, it's not the same. Back in the day, you could say, oh, they're running a Continental because I can tell by the AM noise in the multipath.
Yeah.
Remember those days?
Yeah.
I have breaking some of the, let's dust off the cobwebs. There's a time when you had to tune the transmitter, make, oh, yeah, oh, boy, this is not going to work. My stereo separation is only 10 dB. And too much AM noise, time to tweak, you know, up, neutralize. What else do we do? There's all kinds of things.
Well, and get the temperature right. And make sure you've had it on for a few hours if it was a Continental, because they would change over time.
Oh, yeah. Well, then you had the RCA Amplifuzz. Oh, sorry, Ampliphase. Oh. Back in the day, those AM transmitters. Yeah, I just heard a few people start laughing. I know you're probably retired and enjoying life and going, oh, yeah, I had one of those. We had two of those. They were annoying. So this is the same. The piano behind me, the drums, the Rode P keyboard, the Hammond, same thing. People know exactly how to play them, how to work them, and make certain things happen that are just pleasing to the ear. Just like we do in broadcast transmitters and studios, but in the transmitters. That's the same thing.
Great analogy between the sound of certain musical instruments and the sound of the instruments that we use in our business. Let's bring our guest in, because he's going to have some things to say about this. As I know, our guest is an aficionado of tube equipment, and even though we're in a different era right now, James Copeland. James from Manhattan, Kansas. Welcome in, James. Glad you're here.
Hello, thank you so much for having me, and we are running an 8100 here at KSDB.
Ah, an Orbin 8100 audio processor.
Absolutely. We find that it seems to handle the wide variety of music, because we play anything from jazz to alternative to classical to hip-hop, and it seems to handle it a lot better, so for what it's worth.
Yeah, well, that's why so many people used it. And that was a kind of processor that no matter how you set the knobs, I don't mean no matter how, but, you know, it was hard to make the 8100 sound bad. You know, you could dial in lots of different taste, and it would handle that. They didn't give you a crazy wide range. But, James, give us a little elevator speech on who you are, and then we're going to break for our first commercial and then jump right into our topics today. Who's James Copeland?
Absolutely. So I am was the program director here at KSDB, now the operations manager for the time being. And I definitely like the kind of vintage side of broadcast engineering when I can. Obviously, going ahead and learning all the new digital stuff. And, it's all kind of a task of using the right tool for the right application. So I think, if you've got a situation where an old school solution is going to work, you might as well use it. So, I'm really interested in, broadcast engineering. It's what I do day to day. But I also like being on the air. I do the news, do the morning show here at KSDB. And then in addition, I'm also a licensed amateur radio operator. KD0ICP is my call. And I'm involved here with the K-State Amateur Radio Club. And I really enjoy getting the old tube equipment and stuff up and working and using it on the air. So I guess a passion of mine would be bringing new life to old things and old spaces.
Well, that's very cool. And, I guess a lot of the gear that you have resurrected or are using, reusing, I'm sure budgets are tight. That's probably one reason. And if it works, or if it can be made to work, let's use it. You're using a gear that probably Chris and I and a lot of our audience are already well familiar with. And those who aren't, because they're of an age that maybe you skip that generation, they're going to hear it from you during the show about some of your experiences with this gear. But I'll mention, KSDB, that's the station you're at, is an FM station. And is that Kansas State University's FM station?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have been broadcasting since 1949, and we've been FM since 1951. So really kind of cutting edge in that regard. And I think it's really a cool mix of the old and the new, because, yeah, we do have a lot of, say, older equipment, but we're really on the cutting edge of some things that we'll just talk about maybe a little bit later about how we do remotes and that sort of thing. So it's really a nice blend, I think, of having kind of both worlds.
Yeah, yeah, I'm eager to hear about that, because earlier today you told me that you use both Marty gear and modern cell phone applications to do remotes. And I want to hear, you know, how you decide which to do. Yeah. Hey, we're going to continue on in a minute. James Copeland is here. Chris Tobin is here on This Week in Radio Tech, episode 424. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends at Angry Audio. Let's hear about Angry Audio right now. You know those little live audio mixers? You see them everywhere. Some of them are so good, you may be tempted to use one in a radio station. They're inexpensive, too. Sadly, they're missing some necessary features that, until now, have only been available on expensive radio consoles. Enter the Talk Show Gadget from Angry Audio. The Talk Show Gadget adds essential broadcast features to your live mixer, like a studio monitor volume control and a second input for listening to your air feed. Your monitor speakers will mute automatically to prevent feedback when any mic is live. And speaking of live mics, the Talk Show Gadget even provides logic to illuminate an on-air sign. Hopefully, that'll hush the hallway chatterboxes. LED illuminated push buttons instantly activate up to 4 microphones, so you can get the right mix and then leave those faders in place. Just turn the faders on and off with the buttons on the Talk Show Gadget. From the powder-coated steel enclosure to the internal linear power supply, check it out, the Talk Show Gadget. You can go to angryaudio.com, angryaudio.com. And if you talk to them, if you place an order through one of your favorite dealers, let them know that you heard about it here on This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks to Angry Audio for sponsoring the show. All right, let's jump right in here. James Copeland is with us. Chris is along as well. And I'm here, and we're going to talk about college radio. And Tim, let's give the James, how did we hook up last week? Walter Sabo was our guest, and you did some audio production for him that was fantastic, and that's how we got connected.
Yeah, so Walter's a great guy. I really owe a lot to him. He's a great people connector. You know, he really knows how to put people in touch with each other. Anyway, so Walter had me do this audio production over the summer, actually, called Asbestos Falls on his show, where basically we just kind of told a tale of Manhattan, Kansas in an audio version and kind of flipped it on its head and made it pretty weird. Anyway, so Walter shoots me an email just this, I think, last week and asked about me doing this audio production about college radio and parroting college radio. And, you know, gave me like 8 minutes. He said 8 minutes of notice, essentially, but it's a little bit more than that. But I just kind of threw something together, kind of the big mistakes that I hear on a college station, and sent it over to him. But the great thing about college radio is you can make those mistakes. So it is kind of a double-edged sword there. But it was a lot of fun doing that.
If our listeners go and look at the show notes for last week's show, that is the Walter Sabo interview show, they'll find in there a link to the audio show that contained your college radio parody. And if, hey, whether you're in engineering or programming, you know what college radio sounds like, and you're going to love the parody that I thought was Walter's, but actually James Copeland put that together. Now, James, we were talking about older vintage equipment. Why don't we start there? What are some pieces of older gear? How did you even get interested in older gear? I understand maybe your dad was a bit of an engineer. And so kind of give us an idea of the older stuff, what to you is older stuff, probably stuff that me, Chris and I, you know, got started with. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, my dad's an engineer, and I actually started not a college radio station. I started a radio station in the corner of my bedroom when I was 14. So I had that kind of broadcasting to my neighborhood there, and built it out of Radio Shack components and that sort of thing. But I've always been collecting all sorts of old electronics, going to garage sales and that sort of thing. And so I have so much junk already, and it's ridiculous. By the time I'm, you know, your guys' age, I'm going to have like warehouses or something. It's ridiculous. but I just started getting all this stuff, and also collect vintage typewriters. And when people find out you collect old junk, they just start giving it to you, and you just can't keep up. So It's ridiculous. But I've got a lot of this stuff, and I just kind of started messing around and playing with it and, you know, running my little radio station in my room. So it all kind of grew from that, I think, this interest in just old electronics. And I wanted to figure out, you know, what made them work and how they work. And I've always just been fascinated with stuff that is, you know, just designed in the 50s and 60s. And I kid that I'm not even that good at circuit board wiring right now, because I'm so used to point to point wiring that I burn up circuit boards.
Yeah. So are you a user of ham gear that's tube type and point to point wiring inside?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really like the novice stations of the 50s, where, you know, you got your separate receiver and transmitter, and you got all the stuff that you have to make to go in between it. And so that's kind of what I'm running right now and messing around with. I do have some newer Kenwood stuff, but like the old Globe Scouts, old Heathkit, old Hallcrafters and Hammerlin stuff.
Ah, yeah, some great names. Yeah, stuff that you find at ham shows in, you know, out in the antique lot, right?
But, yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So in terms of broadcast gear, is there some tube type gear that you're using either at your station or you've got some experience with?
We do not. Probably the oldest thing, we've got a CBS AudioMax 3, I think. I think that's right. But it's barely used for anything, just like the cable stuff. But really we are pretty much all solid state here. We actually just did get a new Nautel transmitter not too long ago. So really in the air chain around here, the oldest thing you're going to find is probably from the 70s or 80s. The station actually, burned down in 1968 because of arson. And so we don't have anything before that time period.
Wow. Arson. How did somebody get upset about something you played, you think?
Well, we were located, you know, 1968 was a very tumultuous year in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And we were located in this old, like, it looks like a castle. It's called Nichols Hall on the K-State campus, pretty famous building. And so we were in this along with a professional AM radio station here at K-State. And someone set fire to that building. And I've talked to the guy who was the last DJ on the air. And he said it was a gymnasium. And he said there was a track in there. And he said it was just like a gas burner lighting up. And it was just crazy. So the building burned down and we lost everything. And the local AM radio station here in town took us in and kind of helped us get back on our feet. And then back in the 70s, they built this addition to the auditorium, which also burned down as a separate story, a lot of fire. And so they added us on here. And then they put the professional AM radio station in the basement. And then they built us up here on the third floor. And then in 2003, that station went off the air. It was a time-sharing station. It shared time with another station on the same frequency. They shared the same frequency. And so they were on for part of the day, and then the other station was on for part of the day. And then finally, that station went off the air, and we got all the equipment, a lot of the surplus stuff that came up.
Chris, this reminds me of when I got started in broadcasting. Chris, you may have I don't know if you do or not. When I got started at a public radio station in Richmond, Kentucky, when I first went on the air, this would have been in 1977. I think the winter, the spring of 77. I started there and the station was on 10 watts. It was a 100 kilowatt FM public radio station, but the transmitter had burned down. I'll give you one guess as to what kind of transmitter it was. Pretty famous for burning down. But that's how I started. Did Chris, you got any fire in your radio history?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We definitely do. It was a 25,000 watt AM directional that burnt down to the ground. It was a sad night. I was actually covering for a friend. He was he flew for his daughter's wedding, and I was covering his station. And I got a phone call. I think it was a Saturday night. Yeah, I think it was a Saturday night. So late Saturday night, I got a call from the studio, and the studio operator said, "Hey, I think we're off the air. We have a problem." I said, "Well, what makes you say that? Did you look at the remote control?" "Yeah, the remote control's got zeros on it." I said, "All right, that's a good start." But then again, it was back in the day when you had phone lines as your data telemetry connection. So the phone company could have had a problem. So let's not panic just yet. He goes, "No." Well, he goes, "Yeah, I guess you're right. But then there was this strange call we got." I was like, "A strange call? Telephone call?" "Yes. It was from the fire department. They said that the property's on fire. They're dispatching fire engines. You might want to call somebody." I said, "When did you get that call?" "About 30 minutes ago." "And you called me about 10 minutes ago." "Yeah. So in the time between the call of about a possible fire, this is the fire department calling, and you calling me, what did you do?" Well, I was trying to read the remote control and I had a contest to do, so I had to make sure I did the contest. I said, right, because you're sure you're off the air, but maybe you're on the air, but let's do the contest, because if we don't do the contest, people may be upset. Meanwhile, you got a call from the fire department saying there's a possible fire at your transmit room building. Okay, I'm on my way. Needless to say, as I'm driving up the road to the transmitter site, I am being passed by fire engines. Oh, and I'm saying to myself, that's the third engine that's gone past. As I'm looking down the road, actually sort of like an incline, looking up, I see this glow on the horizon. Mind you, it's 11 o'clock at night, and I see a glow. Now, this is not Alaska, so this is not an aurora borealis moment either. So I'm thinking, this is not going to be a good sight. And I drove up, and sure enough, all I could see is this huge orange glow of a building that was once a building is just a blaze, and streams of water going over the top of it. People running around at the base. I mean, it was like a scene out of a movie. I was like, wow, this is like those movies you see when the people are rolling up with the fire engines with the pumper trucks and they got the handles going up and down and they're running back and forth and they got the buckets. Yeah, it went good. And then the general manager happened to be there and he comes up to me in the car. He goes, it's all gone. It's all gone. I can't believe it. It's just all gone. It was like a scene out of a movie. He just came up to me. He was like, moving for the close-up. Here we go. Just seemed distressed. Seemed as if all is gone, all is lost. And that's what he sounded like and looked like. I mean, the look on his face was like, you know what? Cecil B. DeMille would be proud at this moment because you just did a great, it's all gone. I don't know what to say. There's nothing left. He literally, this is what he said to me. I'm sitting in the car going, yeah, I get it. But man, you are really taking this to heart, which I can understand. And I get out of the car. I walk up and fire battalion chief is there. I said, so how bad is it? He goes, well, we're thinking maybe it's all gone. I'm like, there was 2 25-kilowatt transmitters in there, along with a few other things. Next morning, I go back out, and what was a frame of a Harris transmitter, inside was melted aluminum. Those were the RF modules that were at one time part of the transmitter. Thankfully, the directional array phaser cabinet happened to be at the base of the driven tower. So we were able to fly in. The corporate guys flew in a transmitter, and we were able to get something up and running that afternoon. But that's the fire moment in my history. That's one of there's been two others, but that was the biggie. That was the best one. It was just unbelievable what came across. So, and by the way, here's a tube. If anyone's wondering, by now you should have said to yourself, "Wow, it's a 4-400A. Where did you get that?" Matter of fact, 6 months ago, I repaired an AM transmitter site and found this in the old transmitter that we decommissioned. I was like, you know what? I'm going to take this and polish it up and just keep it handy. And for those of you wondering, yes, it's a tetrode, which means there are four elements in it. Screen grid, control grid, anode, and heater. Yeah, there we go. In case you're not familiar with what a vacuum tube is, maybe you remember these cases. Look at this. Here we go. Check that out. There you go. There's a classic. Yeah. There you go. And yes, there is a tube inside, and it's a metal case.
Oh.
Which one is this one? This is 6J5. Look at that. It's a metal case tube. Many of you may think of the 6L6s in metal cases. Yes, you remember those? See, look at that. Huh. All right. There's a history lesson for you. Vacuum tubes. I'm sorry. For our friends across the pond, this is a valve.
Valve. That's right. It's a valve.
Oh, that's right. I'm being honest. My buddy who lives across the pond would call me up tonight. He's going to say, dude, that's great. I love it. I love when you make these references.
Well, let's fast forward just enough to get into early days of solid state, because that's where James said that he enjoys spending some time also in this. Like James, you said you have a Gateway 80 console, and you kind of like working on it more than some of your more modern analog consoles, like an Arrakis console. You said you have some of those too. So talk to me about your love for consoles and keeping them up.
Yeah. So I had the opportunity actually when I was at a little radio station, little 250-watt radio station in Abilene, Kansas, and they had a Gateway 80 mono console, and that's what they were still using. And I just loved that console. It was a joy to use. I love the rotary console. I mean, I never really thought I would be into that, but as soon as you use it, you're like, oh, this is kind of fun. I could do this. And so they had that console there, and they decided they were going to take it out. And they still hadn't taken it out by the time I was there. And I was actually supposed to get that board. So I don't know what happened with that. maybe I'll have to follow up, because I was like, hey, you're not paying me for this internship. What if you give me the board? And they're like, okay, sure. But I need to follow up.
Those old consoles. Some people are such collectors. I'll throw a name out. There's a guy named Scotty Rice who watches the show. He's out on the West Coast and he loves this old stuff, and plenty of others too. Not just Scotty. There's others as well. Obviously, ham radio guys love old AM transmitters because they can turn them into 160 yes. meter boxes.
That is the life goal. Maybe 80. I don't know. I don't know if all of you have the antenna space for that, but maybe 80.
So a lot of these old consoles, of course, what typically goes wrong, electrolytic capacitors in the power supply typically go bad. You might have, if you had an older power supply in it that maybe even had selenium rectifiers, you might find that those have gone bad. But you can, it's hard to find the old replacements. You can certainly, power supplies are pretty easy to rebuild, you know, using modern components. What sort of repairs have you had to make on older consoles or any other older gear that you've been playing with?
Absolutely. Just as you said, whenever I get into like a receiver or a transmitter, it's always electrolytics. Just go out and replace them all. Paper capacitors too. Definitely. It's just easier to go ahead and replace most of those. And selenium rectifiers, I find that sometimes they do work, but yeah, sometimes they don't. I have reformed a few electrolytic caps. If you have an old, one of those capacitor checkers, you can use those to reform the caps. Results are kind of hit or miss. Sometimes it's just better if you have the ability to go ahead and replace those. And, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, they were using those big, you know, can things that had three capacitors or four capacitors in them. And some people, real purists, will, take the can and take the whole thing out and restuff it and all that. I don't really care that much as long as it works.
I guess if you're not a purist, you can take the can apart and put some ordinary electrolytics in there and hide them in the can.
Oh yeah.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
And people do that. They do that. They actually will take the time to cut the whole thing open and they will put the new electrolytics in and redo everything and get it back on. And I'm like, I'll just leave it there and I'll do everything underneath or something. It doesn't matter that much to me because it's like, I'm the only one who's going to see that and it doesn't matter to me. So I think we're good.
So skills learned in fixing, refurbishing ham gear, I suppose, are perfectly transferable to refurbishing older broadcast gear.
Absolutely. And I mean, the thing that people don't realize is the high voltage, because today people are just so accustomed to 12 volts. And that's a real thing that people really need to get around their head, is that this is, you know, 700-800 volts, and you need to keep that one hand in your pocket, as many mentors have told me before. You know, we've all gotten shocked before. And I think my grandpa said, I've been shocked about any way that you could possibly imagine. So it's really, you do learn from that. But definitely the biggest difference, what I see with people who are used to solid state, is they are not comfortable around high voltage.
Sure. Yeah, that's actually one of my early experiences in engineering. And like you, I'm a lot self-taught. We're going to talk in just a second about your mentor or mentors. Maybe you can tell us about how that's been helpful. But I was largely self-taught, didn't really have any mentors. I read a lot of manuals, spent a fair amount of time on the phone with support at ITC 3M, the cart machine people, and the folks at Harris. Gates Harris, who were, you know, kind enough to spend some time on the phone with me. And after that, I just kind of figured a lot of things out. But one thing, you know, I got shocked pretty badly one time inside an old Gates BC250GY transmitter doing everything wrong. And I was doing everything wrong and got shocked pretty good. It's amazing I'm still here. But I like to tell people I got shocked. I figured out where all the electrons like to hang out. And you know, that's not the best way to do it. I'm glad I'm here to talk about it. But yeah, you got to really respect that higher voltage. Talk to me, James, about mentoring, or in ham radio, they call someone your Elmer, who's helping you learn things.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have really been blessed with a lot of great mentors over the years. When I was 16 years old, I started just going over to a local TV station in Wichita, and Ron and Cheryl Nutt, they're owners of the station, and they just kind of let this high school student kind of run around and do stuff and help them out with their live shows. And I ended up producing a few shows over there. And it was just a fantastic learning experience, just to experience that kind of a little lower budget, a lower power TV station, and just to kind of get my feet wet. And so, you know, Ron is really instrumental in and teaching me a lot of the TV stuff that I started out in. And then, of course, my parents have been really great, you know, teaching me how to solder and that sort of thing. And then in addition, here at K-State, I've really been impacted by Vern Werka. He was the chief engineer at KFAB in Omaha, and then he came here to K-State. He actually is going to be retiring at the end of this year, but he has really taught me so much, and I'm really lucky because Vern is the faculty advisor here for KSDB, but he's also the advisor for the Ham Radio Club. So I got to kind of double dip there and really get a lot of good experience building antennas and troubleshooting. And if ever I have a question, I can just go to him and he'll be able to kind of point me in the right direction and get a tool in my hands. And that's kind of how I learn.
You know, the Society of Broadcast Engineers, SBE, has a mentoring program, and that's been somewhat effective. I hear great things about it. People like Chris Tarr, who has been on the show many times, and also Mark Persons has been a mentor to others. Kim Sachs has as well. So, yeah, and there are plenty more I'm not mentioning or don't know about. So, yeah, mentoring is so important because a lot of this you can read in a book, but you it sure is helpful to have somebody just walk you through and explain what's what and help you avoid disaster while you learn what's what.
Absolutely. There's a lot of tribal knowledge out there.
Yeah. Chris, who if anybody was your mentor in your engineering experience?
Oh gosh, I had several. Well, let's see, my audio and learning audio and a few other doodads of that nature. There was two gentlemen who I had the pleasure of learning from and I still meet up with from time to time as Mike Guardiotti and Paul Sanchez. Paul's still here in the New York market. Mike, I believe, is in Philadelphia. And yeah. Those guys, they're geniuses on many levels, but there was the takeaway I had as a young up and coming and not wise ass, but ask a question like, well, why would you do it that way? Or what's the point? And they'd be like, well, here's why. And this is, you know, someday you'll understand why. And I totally get it. It was totally true. But they did stuff that was so, by today's standards, like unconventional, like that's unheard of. You don't do those things. Like take, for instance, I don't know how many people in the audience remember matrix processing or matrix audio that was used in Tomcat cart machines for one place, yeah. But audio processing for a while. And we all know that Bill Sachs straight wire audio was the place you could buy your matrix carts. And I just probably woke up a few people with that one, like, whoa, I haven't heard that SWA in ages, but it's true. And I remember Mike Guardiotti was on this small station that was not influential at all by any means, according to some people. Oh, I'm sorry. That was WLIR, the new music station back in the 80s. People in the audience go, wait, oh, I remember that station. He was doing matrix processing. And I went out to see him on Long Island. And I said, Mike, your station sounds so loud, but at the same time, sounds like I'm playing the vinyl at home. I mean, how do you do that? How do you make it? And he showed me his two processors that were, I will say, quite modified, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, but the meters aren't moving right. The VU meters seem off. He goes, that's right. That one is L plus R, that processor. That other processor, the other chassis, is L minus R. He goes, watch what I can do with this. He pulls the card out, the output card of the processor out, and there's L plus R, but the FM radio station was still on the air, but in mono. And then he takes the card and puts it back in. Boop, there's the stereo back. How do I know this? Because he had a scope set up, an XY scope on the audio out. And I was like, so how? And then he starts explaining to me the physics of matrixing and 6 dB of audio loss and phasing and what happens if you don't do things a certain way. The processors he was using, DAP 310s. That was my introduction to multiband processing after learning about the Optimod 8000. I was like, wait a minute, what is this? And I took that box apart. I forget what station I worked at. They had a pair on the shelf. They weren't using them. And I took it apart, the schematics. I called Mike Durow. I talked to him. And after that, I just audio processing became my thing. That was one of the things. So that was Paul Sanchez and Mike here in the New York market came up, had all kinds of black boxes that make things go a certain way. Why? New York is a competitive market. I had the time. I didn't know these things. So I learned from some of the best people. And that was on that side. They also were transmitter, you know, gurus as well. So there's some of those things they told me about that was another stuff. But Lenny Kahn was another mentor I had for a short time when I was doing AM stereo, working with at an organization and learning a few things about that. And Don Bordnero, who worked with Lenny, taught me or showed me, explained to me some stuff. And funny thing was that with Lenny, his offices in Westbury, New York, he had a library of technical books that would rival libraries that claimed to be technical libraries. They were first prints, first editions of stuff from Federal Radio Commission, before Bell Labs. There was a name for this laboratory. They did all kinds of stuff. I'm like, I'm reading a Bell Lab. Then I read a Bell Labs book talking about transmission of data, audio via glass. I'm like, what? 1929 is this paper. I'm reading this thing. I'm going, wait a minute. And then Lenny comes over and goes, hey, you thought fiber optics was new, huh? This dates back. Because the problem was they knew how to do it. They knew it could be done, but the technology wasn't available to demonstrate it. Yeah. I mean, how cool is it to be able to sit in a room to read a book about a technology that you're aware of at the moment, but back in the day that when it was talked about, they couldn't figure out how to make it work. They just knew it can be done. They mathematically proved it. I'm looking at first drafts, diagrams of fiber optic material. I'm like, wow. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, these are the people I worked with that I had a chance to work with. It's just fascinating. Larry Titus is another person I worked with when I worked at Chase Broadcasting. And he, was like, yeah, you know what? We can do it this way, but forget it. Let's try this approach. This is going to be better. And man, we did stuff that was like, wow. Even the manufacturers are like, wow, I didn't know you could do that. That's interesting. I like that. All of these people I talk about, and there's many more. Trust me, there's many, many more. They all take the approach of, okay, you say it can be done this way. Here's what my needs are. Here's how we do things. I think I take it to the next level. Today, for people younger than I am, right, say James's age, that concept is difficult to comprehend, to put their head around, because everything is done for you today. You take your smartphone. Oh, I want to do this and that. Done. You don't know how you got to that conclusion or how you got to that end point, but it's done. When I was growing up, and Kirk, I'm sure you can appreciate this and many others in the audience, you pretty much had to understand what exactly a cart machine is doing when that solenoid pulls in the pinch roller that moves the tape in this endless loop that's lubricated on the back with graphite. It's like, okay, I got to understand this because it's jamming up and I don't know why. Or how do I make the audio phase of a cart player as close as possible to perfect because the tape's going across the head and it's actually moving. I'll use my hand up and down. So it's going from left to right and it's going up and down like a wave, like a wave of water. How do you keep it from staying too far off or too far in the middle and not sounding right? Today, it's digital. What does that mean? I don't need to worry. I just turn it on. But aliasing is in digital. There's quantization noise, but nobody talks about that. No one understands it. They just play it. Look, the meters, the LEDs are fine. I was like, no, it sounds really distorted to me. No, they're fine. That's all gone. That's why mentoring is key. In the SBE mentoring program, you will be able to tap the knowledge base that I don't think there's any books that they can even represent it. I mean, if those of you watching and you have SBE chapters or SBE access, go to the website, sbe.org, and learn about the mentoring. And if you're in school, in college, university, at the radio stations especially, as James pointed out earlier, make the mistakes. Trust me. You make mistakes, you will learn much better than not making any mistakes and thinking, hey, this is great. I just did a broadcast for 27 hours and not a problem. Yeah, you know, you're in college radio. You should have had at least one problem. If you didn't, you had it too easy. I know, because I worked in college radio. I worked at a college radio station as a part-time person, being paid as the chief engineer and a student, which at the time I thought was like, is that legal? But I guess it was. And we did a broadcast from a nightclub, spinning records, and we linked it with a radio transmitter from the nightclub back to the studios using a device called an RPU, an RPT, or the brand name as we all love and know and dear to our hearts, the Marty. A college station in New York City back in the early 80s doing a club broadcast. Nobody was doing club broadcasts. We did this thing, and the professor, the person who was overseeing the communications department for the college, Cliff Hesse is his name, a former good guys person from WMCA days. You see now? He was retired from a radio station that people may remember back in the 50s and 60s as the good guys. Retired, went into teaching students and people about broadcasting. So one day he said, how would it be if we could do an event from a club? And everyone's like, why would you do that? He goes, why not? And he gave us all the stories about what they used to do at MCA and all the different things they did. So we were able to get ourselves a Marty, tested it, hooked it up, learned a few things about how to transmit and what to receive and what not to do, and we did it. And we did it for, I think, 6 months. once a month. The things that I learned about club broadcasting and what you do at 11 o'clock at night at a club on a Friday.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy. Let me tell you, today it's a whole show on
that sometime. And I might have a few things to add to that as well with Mississippi club broadcasting from the shotgun.
Every place
shacks.
Has got its own.
The juke joints.
Exactly. But what I'm trying to get across is you have to be able to look beyond the obvious. And what James is pointing out and his love of vacuum tubes, the newer stuff and the older stuff, and understanding it and feeling, you know, yes, I have a Davin potentiometer in my hand. It's a rotary pot on a Gates console. By the way, Gates Way 80, or the Gates, the model, or the, as many people used to know, the sled. That was the other name for the other Gates console. When you put your hand on that fader and you're turning that knob, there is something to be said about the way that feels. And I know friends of mine who are disc jockeys or announcers that, boy, they reminisce in those days. That was fun. You just had a tactile response. But nowadays, it's like, oh, just press a button. Now what happened? It took care of it. Oh, that's not the same. I just don't like that.
Nowadays, consoles have auto mix. You just turn the stuff on, then it takes care of the mix for you. It can be a blessing, but it feels different. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, it feels different, but I will say this. You learn a lot more. You could do a lot more creatively nowadays than you could back in the day, because the barrier to entry back when you and I were doing stuff was much harder to get over than today.
Yeah.
Take, for instance, a Lavo console.
Yeah.
What I told Mike Dosh or Catfish, what was it, last year, about some of the things they were looking to do, which now is a feature, I told him, I said, dude, that opens up possibilities that I know 20 years ago I couldn't have been able to do. I said, now if I was working with somebody who's really creative, I'd look at this and go, yeah, you want to do it? We got it. Done. Make it happen. That's now what's happening.
Coming up after our break, we're going to talk a bit with James about doing remote broadcasts, and you mentioned the word Marty, but James not only is using Marty, he's got a much more modern ways doing remote broadcasts, and we're going to hear about that coming up also. And also, James is a somewhat regular listener to a radio station that's actually just down the street from me, and it's not WSM. It's pretty interesting. In fact, it's a radio station that'll knock your car off the air if you're not careful. What am I talking about? We'll have that coming up. Our show This Week in Radio Tech with Chris Tobin and James Copeland and me, Kirk Harnack, will continue as we roll along here. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. And this week we're talking about something from Henry Engineering. It's the Henry Engineering Sportscaster. If we can take a quick look at it. Ah, yes, indeed. There it is. The Sportscaster is a sports broadcast audio control system. How cool is that? Well, it's actually very cool. It's the missing link in sports radio and video cast audio management. So, hey, you're doing your games on video like so many high schools and colleges are doing nowadays? Well, this can really help you out. It's used with Henry Engineering's sports pods to create an integrated system. So it mixes talent mics and three other audio sources. It provides isolated headphone outputs for announcers, field reporter, camera operators, and a producer. It also includes a comprehensive intercom and talkback system for everyone. And it's absolutely ideal for doing sports, video, webcasts, for doing, of course, doing the audio part for your radio broadcast. It's easy to install and really easy to use. This is such a cool item. You know, Hank Landsberg is the proprietor there at Henry Engineering. And Hank's approach to problem solving is just like this. This is what he does. He thinks about a problem, thinks about what would be the ideal solution in a minimalistic way, but not too minimal. In other words, what's the simplest we can make it, but not too simple, to give you everything you need. So you've got you've got everything you need here with the Henry Engineering Sportscaster to handle the very large majority of sports remote broadcasts like we do. And hey, you got parade coverage coming up, maybe New Year's Day parade, maybe other events coming up in December and January. You've got basketball games, high school or other basketball games. This is absolutely ideal. Those sports pods give your announcers, your color person, your spotter, their own control of their microphones and headphones. That's what they need and they want. But it also gives a producer if you have a producer on site, well, use the producer input for a headset so you can talk to your announcers. You can talk to your camera operators. And of course, you can take the output of this and send it all to the web, send it back to your radio station, hook it up as James Copeland is about to describe to us with some cool products. So check this thing out. If you want to learn all about it, of course, you can go to the website. HenryENG.com. Look for the Sportscaster, or you can go or call our friends at Broadcaster General Store because they know all about it too. They'll hook you right up. BGS.cc is that website, and I think you ought to go there or give them a call. These are the friendliest people on earth. I've been doing business with them for literally 30 plus years. Their number is 352-622-7700. You don't have to write that down or memorize it. You can go to the website. That's what I'm looking at right now. The website at 352-622-7700, and BGS will help you out with that. Thanks a lot, BGS, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and thanks to Hank Landsberg and Henry Engineering for developing and producing this amazing gear, the Henry Sportscaster. All right, let's talk about doing live remotes now with James Copeland, our guest from Manhattan, Kansas, and KSDB. James, talk to me about these methods by which you get audio back to the studio. We've talked touched on one, and how you decide what you're going to do. Old technology and new technology.
Absolutely. So using the right tool for the right application. So we do have a couple RPU licenses still. So we do have two different Martys that we use varying in age, RPT 15 and 30, I think. And we use those generally for we broadcast the Manhattan Municipal Band. It's been going on for like almost 100 years. The band has. And just this last summer, we decided to start broadcasting their concerts live from the band shell. And so a Marty is just great for that. I mean, the band shell is just literally blocks from the radio station. So we just set it up. Mm-hmm. It's great audio quality and don't have to worry about trying to get Wi-Fi out there at the park or anything like that. And then in addition, we do have an old POTS tie line unit that we are still using for our sports broadcasts. And that tends to work pretty well when we are broadcasting K-State football or basketball. You just have that phone line right there and you don't really have to worry about the network going down. But for our news operation and some of the special stuff we do, like election night, we use something called QGo Live. And that is a really revolutionary product that allows you to go live with broadcast quality audio right from your cell phone. And it is just so slick and it works so well. And anyone in the station can have it in their pocket. And they've got it downloaded, and it allows our station to cover events faster than any other media in town. When there are fires in Manhattan, and we seem to have a lot of fires, the library burned down. Like, it didn't burn down, but it had a fire in it. And so that is completely closed for the next year. Because Ooh. it had a fire above the big reading room there, and we were there within minutes. My news director was on the phone, and he was just a student there with his cell phone, but he had broadcast quality audio, and I was anchoring over here, and we were right there. The Topeka, there's no TV station in Manhattan, so if something big happens, it takes almost an hour for the TV stations to get here from Topeka. So I was sending pictures and texting with the anchor on the 6 o'clock news, and we were just live on the air right there. And it's an incredible, a really great product because it allows so much flexibility. And this is a absolutely perfect application of a 21st century tool that allows us to sound really good and really be the best station as far as breaking news when we can.
So actually, QGo Live, this got mentioned last week, and there are other products that seem to be a little similar. I'm curious as to what's different about it. And rather than spend a lot of time on it this week, we're actually going to talk with the fellow who's been in charge of getting it developed and marketing it. It's the company's what, Harris Media? Is that the company that makes it?
Yeah, Lee Harris. I had the pleasure of meeting him at the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System Conference last year. And he is the genius who runs this. And it really is amazing what he is doing with this. So you're going to have him on here next week. So he'll go into like all the nuts and bolts, I guess. But it really is great. I'm actually fortunate enough to actually work for him. So I get to kind of see a little of the behind the scenes. And that's just a real pleasure and honor to do. So I'm really excited about that. But yeah, it's a great product. And it actually works internationally, in other countries, there are servers that are all across the world, and they're continuing to add more. And so it's a really great product, and it's growing very rapidly.
So it's a phone app that not only lets you go on the air live from your phone and with pretty good audio quality, I take it. It also lets you send audio files and embed them in your reports and so forth. Rather than talk about it here, we'll talk with Lee about that next time. But how do you decide when you're going to use the Marty, the POTS box? What was it from Tyline?
It was a Tyline.
And or QGo Live. What's your deciding factor in which method you're going to use to get the audio back to the station?
So basically, a lot of it relies on kind of network reliability. Here in the Midwest, you drive, half an hour out of town, and you may not have cell service. So that is sometimes a limiting factor here in the Midwest. I mean, obviously, that's going to continue to improve and that sort of thing. If you're in a town or something, you're probably going to be okay. And so if we're outside the coverage area of, say, a Marty or something, or if we're doing just something really quick, we're going to use QGo Live. That's going to be the number one choice most of the time. But if we're doing something that is more long form, something that may be more of a hassle to make sure we have, internet connectivity and that sort of thing. Or if, like I said, audio quality is really important, then we're probably going to use a Marty because I can, throw up a directional antenna right there. And I've got a monaural signal, but it'll still be a really good, clean sounding audio. Or if you're going to do a really weird thing, like I did, where we broadcasted live from my car driving around town for an hour. So I just stuck a mag mount antenna right on my car, and it was a car talk show. So they were reviewing my 1992 Ford Festiva, and so we were just driving around town, and I kind of mapped it out ahead of time and to see how far the signal would go. But just a little 15 watt Marty, and we were just driving around. Now I really do want to do an airborne sometime. That would be fun because the RPT-15 is legal for airborne use. So that would be a fun thing to do, but I haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I think we've done airborne a lot
for travel
reporting. But Chris, talk to me about Marty use in a big place like New York City.
I believe it or not, I have used Marty's a lot here in the city, not my current job, but in previous job. And a lot of folks were laughing at me for it, but it worked. And we used it for the 9/11 anniversary coverage. And it was my IFB transmitters. People were like, what is that? And what are you doing? I'm like, it's an IFB transmitter. What? Yes, I didn't use the traditional other products that you could do because the spectrum is kind of busy. So I'm using something that people are not paying attention to. And it worked. Mm-hmm. And but early on, the Marty at a radio station I worked at, the program director, whose name is Bill White, and he's on the West Coast right now, he's another mentor of mine from the non-technical side. He taught me a few things, I should say, about programming, understanding how the audience works and why radio stations need to do things a certain way, and technology needs to be alongside for the ride, and the two have to work hand in hand. So it's one of the reasons why I'm able to talk to a programmer or a program consultant and actually have a conversation and they don't feel like I'm intimidated. And he came to me one day at the radio station. Both of us started about a month apart. And he goes, look, the station's in the pits, right? We have no ratings. We got nothing. We got to do something. What do you say if I can get a budget and we can get a vehicle, a van, and we can get ourselves a Marty system and we can start doing broadcasts? I was like, you get the money, I'll make it happen. I know exactly what you're thinking. So he does. And we did. And we put in the van a Marty unit, antenna on the rooftop, and a couple of things I did. And he decided one day, you know what? The city that we're in, city of Stamford, Connecticut, not Stamford, California, but Stamford with an M, decides they're going to have a new bus service from the railroad station all the way through the downtown district for commuters, for people to come and go. He wants to broadcast live from the back of the first bus that leaves the station. I'm like, okay. There's a challenge. Now, for a lot of you out there going, I just take out my cell phone. Let's remember in 1986, cell phones were not exactly portable. And they weren't actually exactly an economical approach to a long afternoon broadcast with your afternoon drive guy in the back of a bus. So he proposes this idea, and he says, you've got 24 hours to come up with a way to make it work. Otherwise, we lose our client. I said, what? I got it sponsored. He gets it sponsored. I was like, okay, now what do I do? So it just so happened I was a fan of a small network in New York City that used to do marathon coverage. And I watched and learned from their engineering people how they used to do the motorcycle rides and follow behind the lead runner. Yeah, the small network was ABC. And oh. I said, oh, that's interesting. They said, yeah, what we do is we transmit a signal from the back of the motorcycle to receive sites along the route. I was like, oh, okay. And I learned all the technologies they involved. They used microwave 2.4 gig stuff at the time. So I'm like, so how do I apply it to my plan? Thinking, what if our antenna, which was on top of our 500-foot tower that we had, which just so happened to overlook downtown Stanford, which was convenient, with a MARTI antenna at the very top, omnidirectional. What if in the back of the van I make a mount, a 10-foot mast, on top of the mast, a Yagi, a multi-element Yagi, and strap someone in the back, and they just turn and listen to the signal as we're driving, and they keep us connected. Then you say, okay, that's the van, but what about the back of the bus? The RPT-2 we had, a 2-watt MARTI, would relay from the back of the bus to the van receiver. Now, the van receiver was on a Yagi, so the van receiver was always pointing at the back of the bus. We were following behind. I will tell you, it was the most ambitious thing, and Larry Titus, who's the director of engineering for the company I worked for back at the corporate office in Hartford, Connecticut, he said, okay, I'm just going to roll with it. You're on your own if it doesn't work. And we just did it. And I will tell you, that was our first foray into what would become a regular occurrence for live on-location broadcast for the radio station. And we went from zero ratings to the number one station in the market within 13 months. And it lasted in that position until the ownership change 7 years later. So just for those of you who think it's not possible, you just need to think a little bit outside that crazy box we call life. And you'd be surprised. And observe what others are doing. Now, remember, I got the idea to do this from watching the marathon coverage in New York City and how they did it. It wasn't some book I picked up and go, here, how to use your MARTI transmitter in an application for an outside broadcast. Page 12. Oh, look, apply the following. No, wasn't there. And then later on, we did a broadcast from a St. Patrick's Day parade. And I got the idea of using a backpack frame, hiking backpack frame. And on the back of that, we mounted, with an extension on the antenna, an RPT-2 with a battery pack and a wireless mic. It became our wireless mic. And our news director, Randy Gorbman, he walked the parade route with the wireless. And I have a picture somewhere of him wearing this square frame backpack. You know, the backpack's missing. It's just a frame and a MARTI RPT-2 attached to it with an antenna above his head, wearing headphones, reporting from inside the parade along with the people performing. The best part was our competitor in town. Well, all they could do was sit by the sidelines next to our van and report what they saw while we were actually in the parade reporting it as well as along the sidelines. Once again, sponsored, and we were able to garner some more revenue. So, James is on the right foot. He's got the MARTI, Tyline, or POTS codec, and then the QGO Live. And the QGO Live is definitely gives you that ability to think even more. What I had back then was limited, but today it's your imagination is what limits you.
I want to real quick cover one more thing before we take our last break, and then we got a tip of the week that's pretty interesting too from James, and I'm sure that Chris will have one too. But James, you told me that you listened to a radio station from around my neck of the woods, WTWW. Tell me what you know about this radio station.
Yes, well, broadcasting from the banks of the Upper Cumberland River, this is WTWW. I have listened to that many times, and I love the music they play, and I really do like shortwave radio, and I'm happy to hear someone playing some really great music and great ham radio-related programming on shortwave bands, because there's not a lot of programming on the air these days, but I really appreciate that. So, yeah, I'm a frequent listening on Hallicrafter's SX99. And so I've heard about it, and that was one of the first things I asked you. Do you know anything about this station?
Yeah, actually, of course, our friend who's been on the show before, Ted Randall, does a show, the QSO radio show on WTWW. Well, but what frequency do you listen to them on?
I listen on 5085.
5085.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So Ted is on. I've been on his show before. I'm not sure why. We just chatted. It was a pleasant chat. He played some great music, and he's been having a lot of guest DJs on, people who were previously had previous careers at great Detroit and Chicago and Cleveland radio stations. But yeah, so WTWW and their transmitter site is east of Lebanon, Tennessee. It's almost an hour drive east of where I am here in Nashville. But we had an SBE meeting out there some years ago. We need to have another one. And there's a huge rhombic antenna. And I'm before the break, I mentioned about it'll kill your car. A lot of cars, if you drive onto the property up the driveway toward the transmitter building and you drive under this rhombic antenna, it'll kill your car. I mean, not permanently, but it'll stop your car dead as tracks, right? Your car will just stop running. I was going to take a chance. I drove my old 4Runner up in there and the car kept running, but the blower in the HVAC system, the blower went crazy nuts. It stopped and then went like super fast and then stopped and super fast. And well, this is pretty interesting. So it turns out that the Nissan company brings some cars there every few months, once or twice a year, and they test them in this very high RF field, you know, 100 kilowatt shortwave transmitter under the middle of a rhombic. And if they pass the test, then the engineers at Nissan are very happy. So, well, that's cool that you listened to that. So aside from Ted Randall's show, is there anything else you like on there?
Yeah, I listened to Ham Nation. They'll carry the audio of the live broadcast. And that's a lot of fun, too, to be able to tune into that. You know, I'll just flip it on and there it is. And I can, again, keep working or whatever. And I think that's really great that they're supporting the ham radio community by providing this programming.
Sure, sure. And it does well listener-wise all around the world. Hey, it's time to take our last break real quick. Our show This Week in Radio Tech. We've got Chris Tobin here with great stories. And James Copeland is here, young engineer who's up and coming and loves the old stuff. So it's great to talk to James because he can kind of talk our language of old guys like me. And yet he's looking forward and working with newer stuff, too. And we just haven't got enough time with James. We need to have him back on. But our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo. No tubes in their gear. Let's hear from Lavo. And we'll continue in just a moment.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the Jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual-mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And when you go to their website, if you add the /twert, lavo.com/twert, it'll take you right to the radio products. And also, it'll let them know that that we sent you. So appreciate that very much. This Week in Radio Tech, we've just got our last quick segment here. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin. And our guest is James Copeland from Manhattan, Kansas. James, you're going to talk about something you call the junk box. What is a junk box and why is that important to you?
Absolutely. The proverbial junk box. I've got a whole closet behind me that is crammed to the gills with junk. But that is my number one source for fixing things. If something goes wrong, I know where whatever I need in there. I can usually piece something together. I made a whole newsroom mixing system out of the junk box. So it really is. I think one of the biggest assets you can have at your station, and nothing pains me more than to see station management come in and say, "Oh, clean up all that junk. You know, we don't need to have that around here." And yes, you should try to keep it organized, but nothing is worse than trying to make things at a station and realizing that you don't have a pile of resistors or that random, you know, a piece of wood or something. I mean, it's just so valuable, I think, to be able to have parts and pieces that you can throw together and make something work. So keep your junk box around, try to organize it. But I think it's your biggest station asset.
Yeah, and it takes experience to know, okay, what is absolutely – look, I haven't used this in 28 years. I'm probably not going to, and it really is junk. Versus, yes, you know, we could put this to use sometime if we had an emergency. Like you said, parts, you know, resistors, capacitors, and then who knows? You might need a telephone coupler sometime. You hadn't needed in a long time, but maybe you got to go do a quick broadcast, and all that's there is Granny McGillicuddy's POTS line, right? And you need to hook a mic to it, so or a mic
absolutely.
Mixer.
If you're still holding on to that analog satellite uplink system that is taking up a 10 square feet or something, it's time to let go of that. So there is a fine line, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, or that old Connell rad. James, that is before your time, isn't it?
I'm aware, and it's a very bad thing for your modulation transformer there.
Yeah, exactly. Chris Tobin, what have you got for us in terms of a tip this week?
Well, since we're talking about organizing junk or not junk or just organizing in general, a reminder, in our performance space I have here, I have all our cables are numbered because you know what it's like putting together a 16-piece band and running cables, and all of a sudden the sound engineer or the mixer engineer says, "Hey, you know what? I got a buzz on the vocal mic," and you're looking like, "I've got 37 cables on the floor. Which one is the vocal mic?" Oh, that's right. I have
a number.
Number. Look at that. So if the microphone is on the stand like so, we look at the number, and we go back to the patch panel and go, "Oh, number 45. We'll move that out. Done. And now what happens if you happen to have one of those old Craftsman battery-operated screwdrivers that's no longer in use, but you still have the plastic case? You ever think of this? Label the box, mic flags for your radio station, and there you go. Ah. There you have it. Your mic flags handy on the shelf. Not the mic flags thrown in a bag that all get crushed up and bent and dangled and worn out. If you ever watch a television newscast, you'll notice that those microphones, the flags never come off the mic to go into a box and get bounced around in the back of the truck. And if you happen to have a Glyph hard drive case that you no longer need the hard drive for or whatever you're doing with, look at this. You can make yourself an SM58 case. That's right. I have SM58s we use. And there they are. Dun-dun. Ready to go. And by the way, keep the mic holder on the microphone. Do not separate them. Don't be like some of those anal sound guys that everything has to have a separate box, because you'll never find the mic holder when you need it. Trust me, we've been down this road. Yeah. I finally got people to say, you're right, we should keep it together. So there you go. So right now, and you know what's funny? Just yesterday, we were doing something in one of the studios, and one of the production folks came in and said, "Hey, we're taking some photos for the holiday for a piece that we're doing, a year-ender. We have any mic flags? Where can I find the mic flags?" I said, "It's funny you should ask. Let's go to the closet." And we opened the door, and what's behind the door? There's the case. It says mic flags. They were happy. They walked right out. They're like, "This is great." I was like, "There you go." And that's the point behind organizing and doing it logically. That's all I'm saying. Don't get crazy with the P-Touch product or labeling in general. "Oh, everything's – make it so that it follows your workflow." That's all.
Chris, you've brought out another failing of mine in your brief. Not only the labeling, because you know what, I like it when people use colors. But if you got 47 microphones, there are not enough colors to handle that.
No. And I know there are folks who have emailed me about my constantly harping on labeling and doing this documentation thing. Just today, working with, no, sorry, last night working with some folks. They asked me for help. And I said, okay, I'm on the phone. I have no idea what you're doing at your other end, but this, that, and the other had to do with routers. IP, it was routers that were setting up for video IP codecs. And I said, okay, the ones that we installed had the following. Do you have the information, the documentation? No. Okay, let's work on it. We started writing. I started writing down. They were yelling out IP addresses for stuff. Mm-hmm. I wrote it all down. So I said, okay, let's go back to the laptop, type in the IP address of the codec, and you should be able to port forward to the firewall and blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, I can't get into the unit because the LAN isn't working. My computer isn't. I don't have the – I said, did you not write down the IP address we just talked about? He goes, no. Well, funny thing, I did. Here you go. Type it in. Let's see what happens. It's important. This is crisis mode. They were trying to solve a problem, and they're in a crisis mode, and you're not documenting as you go along. I keep a book with me when I'm doing these projects, even if it's experimental, which I've done a couple of times. And it's like, do-do-do-do-do, and all of a sudden somebody calls, you know, we worked on this X, Y, and Z, and I can't figure out what we did. Hang on. What date was it? Here's what you need to do. How'd you know? Oh, man. Because everyone's so hot to take their tablet and type things in, because that's the better way to do it. No. Pencil and paper works just fine. Yeah. Trust me.
Hey, I would love to have all my show notes typed in, but no, it's easier just to do them right here. So I'm sorry you couldn't see that.
Yeah.
That's okay. And
there is importance to this.
The failing you reminded me of is you may think that this is a piston for a Wankel engine, but no, it's a mic flag. It's a mic flag that Kirk bought 4 years ago and still hasn't freaking labeled.
My mic flag has those same Funkin' Wagner looking rotary engine things in it, but it does have a label.
Yes, I know yours has a label. I was even going to get beggy and ask you, could you just print that off for me and send it to me? But no, I'll do a label. I've got a printer right over here. It shouldn't be that big a deal. I've got to get around to it, but all I've got is triangles. I even bought two different mic flags. I got these like real cheap somewhere. They're both triangular, but James Copeland, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any last word? We got to go in just a second, but have you got any last word for us?
Well, just have fun. If you can do college radio at least once in your life, I'm kind of near my end, but if even you can come back or something, try it out because it's so much fun.
I think most of us have done some college radio. Most engineers I know have been around some college radio, and that's where they've learned. I even learned carrier current at a college radio station. Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky did carrier current. Wow, man, that brings back memories. James, thanks so much.
Don't run your
go ahead.
One more thing. Don't run your radio station off of extension cords more than one time a week that I did. So there you go.
We didn't even get to that. We got to have you back
that's okay.
on. The
that's air. All right.
Thanks for joining us on short notice. James Copeland from KSDB in Manhattan, Kansas. And just appreciate him. Engineer and production guy, if you want to hear his work, you can go back and look at last week's show notes for Walter Sabo for the college radio parody section of Walter's show. It was hilarious. Chris Tobin, thank you for taking the time to be with us from the Holiday Studio.
Yes, time for some eggnog and Southern just eggnog.
Hey, I'm sorry we got to head out of here, but we're on a tight schedule. And Suncast, thank you for doing the show. Your usual fantastic job. I really appreciate you. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Without him, we may not have a place to be. So we really appreciate letting Andrew us sleep on his couch every week. All right, we got to go. Next week, our guest is Lee Harris. We're going to get into the technicalities of doing live remote broadcasts from your cell phone in some pretty, pretty cool ways that I think will just bring us right up to speed. Hey, tell your friends about our show This Week in Radio Tech. Please go visit our sponsors. That's really important. Helps us a lot. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.